do they put benzene in Divide Creek? By drilling for gas in the ground. By drilling for gas in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to 88.7 WHCL-FM, Clinton, New York. I'm your host, Pete Bianco, and this show is The Ringer. My guest this morning, Lech Kowalski. He is the director of the new film Drill Baby Drill, which is making its American premiere here in the U.S. in Utica, New York, at the Uptown Theater this Saturday, March 16th at 4 o'clock p.m., and admission is $5, so I hope you come on down. Welcome, Lech.
Thank you. It's at the Uptown Cinema. Did you mention that?
Yes, Uptown Theater, Uptown Cinema.
Across from Domenico Cafe.
Yeah, so that's about 2014 Genesee Street, I believe.
Yeah, and there's people coming from Pennsylvania to the screening.
And I think that that's an extremely important thing for people to note, that there'll be people there from Pennsylvania who've actually witnessed this themselves, so you can come and there'll be a question and answer afterward where they can talk to the people and get some personal information about. Yeah.
There's also a psychologist coming from Pennsylvania who's in the film, and she's been involved with this anti-fracking. She's a psychologist who was involved with treating people in Pennsylvania, in the area that she lives in, for various stresses caused by hydrofracking operations. And she's been doing this for a few years, and she's developed an entire sort of a method of explaining the various problems that people go through, emotional and physical problems, because of the hydrofracking industry being in Pennsylvania. And it's a very powerful presentation that she gives with a computer.
And so will she be doing this after the film?
She'll be doing this after the film, yeah. And she'll be doing a short thing so it doesn't, belabor the issue. But she's such a great speaker, and she has so much experience. And she's been involved with this thing right from the very beginning. And there are not that many people like that who have experienced the entire sort of spectrum of this sort of invasion. And she's analyzed it, and she's put it into sort of, she's analyzed it from medical terms, with medical terminology and with how to treat people with it. And she's sort of gone through the process of thinking about it and figuring out how to explain it to people so that they can understand what they will possibly go through or how they can deal with it, because there's a lot of emotional issues connected to this issue. Like, for instance, homelessness, people being displaced by workers who are coming up to Pennsylvania from the South, essentially, to work on these drill rigs and pipelines, who have, are given quite a bit of money to live in places where they work, and they're displacing people because they're renting homes that, poor people can't afford. So suddenly the rents in the area went up high. So the hydrofracking thing has a lot of implications that go way beyond gas. It affects the community. A hospital was recently closed there because of problems related to this. A lot of the hospitals are overburdened with accidents, hospitals that were not designed to accept all this traffic that this hydrofracking movement has brought into the neighborhoods. So these hospitals are under stress, and they also don't know how to treat some of the new kind of problems that they've been having to treat. So there's a lot of community issues there that hydrofracking is sort of stirring up the pot and causing people to sort of suffer, I guess, in ways that we can't even anticipate. And no one knew about this, because this is not the kind of thing where the industry came in and had meetings with the community and said, okay, here's what's going to happen. Here's what's going to happen. Here's how well it's built. Here's the pipeline situation. Here's the kind of problems you may have with your water. Here's the kind of problems you may have with your community, because in some places there's so much traffic going through that people can't drive normally the way they did. So these are all, these problems accumulate, and they become problems that are much bigger than just getting the gas out of the ground. Mm. It's a lifestyle. It affects the way people live. And, a lot of people, there are people that say, well, it's great that they're in our community, but most of those people are directly connected to hydrofracking because they are leasing their land and making some money from it, or because they have a car company, or they have some kind of facility that is making some money from this thing. But don't forget, this is a temporary issue. For these companies are going to come in, drill these wells, put in the pipeline, and as soon as that thing is sort of set up, they're out. So that it's a temporary kind of way to make some money. But what happens when they leave, and they leave behind the kind of mess that they created? It creates kind of a hole in a neighborhood in society.
When we were in southern New York, we picked up a newspaper called the No Frack Almanac, and that had documented the homelessness problem. Could you talk a little bit more about why people are getting to be homeless from this?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it myself. Well, you have to sort of draw a picture in your mind of what Pennsylvania looks like, this part of Pennsylvania. It's farmland. A lot of the farms are not as productive as they were. These farmers have a lot of land that they're not really using because farming is difficult. The big corporations, it's really interesting. When you talk about these issues, you're also talking about corporate reality, and corporate reality comes into your life from many different angles. And what I mean by that is that, you know, the kind of food we eat and the kind of, you know, when you have farmers who are competing with big multinational agricultural companies that are producing food for, you know, McDonald's and the food that you buy in Price Chopper, etc., that farmer is then sort of at the mercy of these agricultural companies. So in many instances, some of the things that these farmers produce have a very low value put on them because, for instance, the price of milk, for instance, in the world is governed by the lowest price of milk in the entire world. For instance, in Poland, in Europe, which is where I live now, the price of milk in is governed by the lowest price of milk in the world. And the lowest price of milk in the world for a while was in New Zealand. So that lowers the price of milk around the world. And it's hard for farmers to compete with this kind of thing. So you have these kind of problems going on. So I took a little diversion from what I was talking about. But what was I talking about? What was the question?
About homelessness.
Oh yeah. So what happens is that this company will these fracking companies, let's just call it fracking to make it easy, come in, and they have to bring in people who work on these operations, and the people that live in this area, a lot of them are lower income people. They live in trailer parks. In towns, kind of look a little bit like Utica, but a little bit more stressed financially, and they don't pay much rent because they can't afford to pay much. So these workers come in, and the people, and they're looking for places to live. So as soon as they come in, I think the stipend is between $1,000 and $1,500 for living expenses that some of these workers get. And they use this money for rent. So immediately the rents go up, and some of the landlords and people that own the land see the opportunity to make some money, and they rent their spaces to these people and force people out. I know there's a lot of people live in trailer parks, and trailer parks have been going under this experiencing the same kind of stress where they need the land. So they have to move a trailer park where people have been living for 20 years. People who live in trailer parks don't have a lot of money. They invested all their money and energy to sort of build up their little trailer, and you know, they can't just move this thing somewhere where are they going to move? You know, it's very hard to find land for a trailer park, you know, for your trailer. Mm-hmm. There are not that many trailer parks. So, you know, if you start sort of multiplying this, with this fact, which is this, it is, and I learned this not from the industry. I learned a lot of these things from investment kind of companies that give you advice on what to invest in the world of investing, and that's a very good place for information. You get more information there that's true than from the gas companies. What I learn is that it takes the oil companies or the energy companies have to build or they have to drill on an average of 3 wells per day to make it profitable. So just think about how much work this activity this generates. So every day, 365 days a year, they have to build on the average of 3 wells per day to make it profitable. It doesn't mean that all these wells are going to be productive, but they have to keep drilling them because some wells produce more gas, some produce less gas. It's not a consistent thing. So there's an average here, and that's what they figured out what it is. So all this work causes stress on the community.
When I went to a town board meeting in Westmoreland here, there was a town board member who had said they went down to Pennsylvania and they met people who got excited about getting into the business here. They're going to make a lot of money, and they bought trucks to haul water. And I don't know what the time frame was, but maybe 8 months later, all the activity was gone, and they still had payments on this truck, and the work had left town. So either they'd have to follow the work, or
it's a very good point you're making, and because I've shot scenes and interviews with people who've done this exact thing that you're talking about, where you know the woman has a family, they have two or three kids. This one specific woman has I think two children. They bought a house. Her husband has a certain kind of job. I forget what it is, and she has a job. And her husband and their brother-in-law invested in buying two trucks. And it's not as easy as it seems. And these trucks are used to haul the dirty water that they use for or the clean water, depending on the situation. And you know, they buy these trucks. They invest in these trucks, and these are used trucks that they're buying. They can't afford to buy new ones. And I think they invested something like $100,000 or a bit more. And as this was going on, where they live, suddenly they discovered they were right in the middle of this area where there were a series of four drillings around their area. So they were surrounded by gas wells, and there was a gas well within about 1,000 feet of their house, and they were surrounded by gas wells on all sides. So they were getting this noise from the gas wells, this traffic all that's surrounding them, and they were saying, "My gosh, we made a deal, which is kind of a Faustian deal. We invested money in the companies that are actually the ones that are destroying the kind of life that we lived here, because they live in a countryside where it's supposed to be quiet and nice and it's beautiful, except if you have these fracking operations." So I know they've gone out of business. They had to get rid of the truck or something. They had some problems. But this is a very interesting issue, because in one way they think, okay, they're going to come in and they're going to invest in it and make some money in it. At the same time, these companies are coming in and working in their area, and these people are like against it and for it. And this too causes psychological stress. So what do you do with this kind of family? You can't sell your house. Who's going to buy it? Mm-hmm. So you have to figure out how to deal with life in a different kind of way that you live, you know, that than what you planned on.
And be careful what you invest in, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah. Another issue that the same person had brought up is when he was down there, he said the traffic was so intense that it took what used to be a 2-minute trip now would take something like 20 minutes and longer. He said, but then after that was over, so many months later, he said, then you could walk right down the middle of the street. It was like a ghost town.
Yeah. I mean, there's a diner in one of the places where there's two gay guys run it, and they're from New York. And they've been watching this whole thing going on, and they were explaining to me how it's either boom or bust, and it's hard to make a business plan based on this, because you know, for a few days or for a few weeks or for a few months they have a lot of business, and then when the people move along, the workers, suddenly there's no more business. So they had to, it affected their business, the way they run their operation, I think that, I mean, look, my whole thing about this is that, in fact, I'm not against the shale gas, and I'll explain this to you because this may sound a little strange. I think the shale gas is down there, and it should stay there until and if it can be taken out safely and without you know, poisoning the environment. Because the way that I see our reality going in terms of the way that society is structured, you know, we're going through this amazing crisis now. You know, it's been going on for a few years since kind of when Obama became president, when, you know, he came into office the first time at a very stressful moment where he had this, you know, this financial crisis that exploded. I was here filming in New York then, and this was 4.5 years ago. And ever since that, you know, America and a lot of the West has been living in kind of a nightmare, an economic nightmare. There's a lot of reasons for that. I don't think it's going to move away. So this fracking thing has come in at the same time that they have this economic crisis. So what I'm seeing is that society as we know it is going to change. And I think what's going to happen is that we're going to, you know, as time goes by and oil becomes more expensive and energy needs become more and more expensive and more difficult to it'll become more difficult to get to the energy that we need, we're going to start living in more isolated communities. And each community is going to have to figure out ways to get to energize itself. So they're going to use solar energy, they're going to use water energy, they're going to use probably various, you know, they're building these little sort of nuclear reactors that you can buy for 30 years. That might become an issue. and of course this hydrofracking thing. I think that eventually, and they're doing experiments with that now, there probably will be a way to get that the gas from underground. But that gas should be used for the community and should be done in a clean way, and it should be sort of voted on in a town hall with a mayor and the people from the community saying, okay, here's how we want to do it, here's the land that we want to protect, here's the water sources that we have to be careful about, and let's use the gas here and not sell it to Japan for a profit that we will not make, but the energy companies will make. So we have to think about the future. So in 30, 40 years from now, when energy is really going to be a very complicated issue, that's the time when people are going to have to start looking for, you know, taking advantage of these kind of things. Not now when it's premature.
Right. I just want to remind the listeners, you're listening to 88.7 WHCL-FM, Clinton, New York. If you would like to give a call here and get in on the conversation, you're welcome to. The telephone number is 859-4561. That's 859-4561. So this will be your American premiere of the film.
Yeah.
So that's exciting. And is there any other places that it'll be showing after it shows here in Utica?
Well, you know, actually, it's a good point that you raise, because usually, you know, you don't have premieres in places like Utica for a lot of reasons. You know, you usually have a premiere in New York City or Hollywood or Boston or the big cities. And this film is, I live in Europe now, and the financing for films there is sort of different than it is in the States. So this was financed by Arte, which is a television network, a little bit like PBS, and they finance things that are kind of radical or hard to sell to the general public, and so we had our big premiere in Europe and on television. It's very hard to sell this kind of film on television in America, because the corporations have their hold on this thing and they're afraid of the subject matter. So my idea is that I think that the community is really important. And it's communities like Utica that I think are should be respected, and people should come to communities like Utica and have their premieres here and help the community to sort of expand beyond what the corporations are offering us as entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why, and plus my mother lives here, and I went to high school here, so I had this sort of, and of course the fracking issue is very big in New York, so I had this idea for having the opening here and bypassing New York and all those other places, which is, it'd be nice to have it there, but it's much more emotionally and intellectually stimulating to do it here. And the idea now is to have this opening here, and then we want to set up a drill baby drill tour of the Eastern United States and show it in theaters and storefronts and churches and schools and to wherever people are interested in seeing this film. And we're doing that now. We're organizing that now. And there's a huge interest.
I also appreciate that you're using a independent cinema that's locally owned. So, you know, keeping it all to something that's locally owned.
Yeah. I love this place.
Yeah,
I love it. It's such a great place. I went there the first time the other day, and to see the operation there. First time, because I was, as a kid, I went there, but I haven't, been involved in this new reincarnation of the Uptown. It's great. It's like there are very few cinemas like that left. And, I don't know the owners, but I'm sure it's difficult for them to run this place and get people to come to the cinema. But it was nice to do this in that venue.
So for people who are listening and want to host the screening of this film, how do they get in contact with you?
We have a website. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We're on everything. So they can send an email to me, which is usually what people do. It's kowalskilek@yahoo.com. And Kowalski-Lek is spelled, I'll spell it very slowly. It's like Stanley Kowalski, if everybody knows the play. Kowalski. My first name is Lek, L-E-C-H. It's an old Polish name. @yahoo.com. And if you send me an email, I'll contact you and we'll figure out how to do a screening.
So there's a few different ways that you're going about publicizing the film, and I have this one in front of me here that kind of looks like an old horror science fiction comic book, and it's Rick Trumbull's Motion Pictures Purgatory Drill Baby Drill.
He's an artist who lives in Montreal. And he's been doing this column. He does his reviews this way, And he's been reviewing and working on my films for going back years to the rock and roll stuff I used to do with the Sex Pistols and the Ramones. And I called him on this. I said, listen, give us a visual treatment of this film in a comic book fashion. And he gave me one page, and I love his work.
That's very interesting. Okay, so in the first cell, C, Chevron, try to pull the wool over Polish farmers' eyes by assuring them there'll be no consequences consequences for hydrofracking for shale gas on their ancient pastoral soil, where the air is clean in the regions known as the lungs of Poland. But Sinesta, Lech Born to Lose, Last Rock and Roll, and the Last Rock and Roll Movie, Kowalski, knows full well what can go horribly wrong, and duly demonstrates by ricocheting from Pennsylvania to Europe, showing what kind of devastation is in store. C, caterpillar-like rows of trucks creeping across farmland doing seismic tests to locate oil that rattles so deep underground they crack homeowners' walls and turn their crystal-clear water black like pea soup. And there's some illustrations to go along with that. C, mom show off a suspicious rash, weeping how her daughter's lost 10 pounds in a week with diarrhea, high white cell counts in her urine, fluid in her abdomen, and an enlarged spleen, liver, and ovary until she left town for better water to prevent proprietary info from reaching the general public. The industry successfully lobbied a gag order on doctors, preventing them from telling patients of any symptoms. Pennsylvania is a crime scene, a post-traumatic stress specialist laments.
And that's the psychologist who's coming at this quote from her.
And that sounds like must be Carol French that he's talking
yes,
about
yes,
there.
Yes, yeah.
I recognize the story.
Yeah.
So that's it's peculiar to see that these are people's lives who have been destroyed, and now it's, you know, in this comic book form, but this is a way to communicate the story to people.
Yeah, I mean, you know. It's interesting, this whole fracking thing is something that I discovered with the farmers that I was making another film with in Poland. So I didn't know anything about fracking. In fact, I was on a field one day filming a farmer working on his wheat field. And he told me that, this is in Poland, eastern Poland by the Ukraine, really an amazing part of the country. Very virgin, there's no industry there at all. The air is incredible. And we're on his field filming, and he said to me, you know, there's industry, there's some kind of industry trucks here looking for oil. And he used the word oil in Polish, which is the same word for gas. And I thought, in my mind, I thought, oh, they're going to be drilling for oil here like they do in Texas, you know, like Beverly Hillbillies kind of thing, if you remember that show. So that went through my mind. And then we were talking longer. He said, no, it's shale gas. And I didn't really understand what shale gas was. I didn't understand what the whole thing was all about. Of course, I learned a little bit about this in geology and when I was in school. But then I researched it, and I discovered shale gas, the whole shale gas issue, as did all the other farmers. So together we were learning about this thing, and you know, gradually I became very interested in it, only because I discovered it with these farmers. Had I not been there, I probably wouldn't have made this film, because I wouldn't know anything about this issue. Normally, I don't make films about things that are sort of, I'm not like an ambulance chaser where I'm looking for subject matter. I usually make films that affect me directly or indirectly. So because I was with these farmers, and I'm interested in making films about agriculture, or that film about agriculture, I became interested in this issue, because this, by learning and reading and studying this on the internet, I discovered that it's a very important issue. It's connected to energy. It's connected to sort of everything that's going on in our lives, because if we don't have energy, we can't do anything. And because of peak oil, because the price of oil, when price of oil goes above a certain point, things like shale gas drilling become profitable. So I learned this with the farmers. And there's a tremendous amount of information on the internet about this. And there's more and more and more as people learn about it. But it's information. So I made this comic and I made this film, in order to try to figure out how to take this information and this knowledge and put it into a form that allows people to learn about it without just, you know, reading just, you know, hardcore information, put it into narrative form, put it into a film form where there's a story, etc. So it's just another way of telling stories for me.
Well, I think we're very fortunate to have you make a film about this because the issues are very underreported. All I see reported is industry advertisements on TV all the time, and you get a few stories here or there, and the journalism isn't very good, and so we're left wondering about it. And then you have the gag orders. You've got non-disclosure for people whose water's been spoiled. So we're hearing a lot about the potential upside to it, but very little about the risks associated.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, the gas industry, the energy industry, you know, Chevron, which is the company that is the one that film we're fighting against. Chevron is the fourth largest energy industry in the world. I mean, they have you know, billions of dollars. There's a case in that they were involved with in South America. They were fighting against these indigenous people there who were really upset with Chevron, but this has to do with oil, not with gas, and not with shale gas. And this has been going on for almost 10 years. They used 500 law firms to fight these indigenous people in South America. That's how much money they have. So, you know, you're like, it's almost like it's beyond David and Goliath. It's ridiculous the amount of power and money they have, as opposed to, you know, a small group of farmers or like you or myself. So these issues are very important, and it's, you know, like I consider this issue kind of like in a way, you know, the farmers' cause. I look at the farmers like I do a lot of my other subject matter that I've made films about, like the homeless, etc. I'm interested in the underground, and now the, you know, like there is no cultural underground left anymore because everything has been sort of, you know, is taken. Everything is sort of commercial in a certain way now. But now lifestyle and the way that, you know, we're being attacked by the corporations in all the ways that they attack us, we find ourselves as individuals trying to survive being the underground. And so I'm taking like an underground pot shot with my rifle, which is my camera, at this corporation and this issue. And I plan to do this, continue to do this, because I've shifted my filmmaking focus from cultural underground to survival underground. And I consider this a survival underground issue. And it's very exciting to confront these big corporations because, like, for instance, every time I filmed, whether it's in Pennsylvania or in Poland, and I spent 2.5 months filming, every single time that I filmed in a place where they were drilling or building a pipeline, I always was confronted by them telling me not to film. In whatever context it was, don't film, don't point the camera here, don't do this, don't do this, don't do that. Big signs, don't do this, don't film here, don't walk on our land. When you see all this and it starts accumulating and it's always no, don't do this, don't do that, don't do this, you have to wonder what are they hiding? Mm-hmm. Because they are hiding things. And they're hiding things because they want to make profit. They don't care about the community. They don't care about poisoning the rivers or the streams or whatever waters there is underground, which is extremely important to farming. They don't care about that because what they care about is profit. So if they're working in that kind of scenario, we have to look at our situation and say, listen, there are more important things to our lives than just profit for corporations. We have to profit from the air and the water we live on, because if we don't have that and it's not clean, then we have nothing.
And when you're talking about all the don'ts and the secrecy, that, you know, so that's one layer of secrecy, is they're trying to prevent people from seeing what's happening. And then you've got the gag orders, and you've got the non-disclosure. Right. And then the industry has exemptions, at least in the United States, from different environmental protections. So something that shows up on the site as a regulated toxic material, which is the chemicals that they're using, once it gets to the site, it's no longer regulated like that. And then once it gets to the site, it's no longer tracked from that point on. So then we get the problem of illegal dumping, because there's not a cradle-to-grave system of following this chemical where it goes. Yesterday, I went to the Madison County Board of Supervisors, and a man testified there who was hauling waste, where they were taking waste from Pennsylvania, which was the fracking chemical waste after it came back out of the
tilings,
and they were putting it into trucks with wood chips. They're soaking the wood chips in these chemicals, and then they were bringing it to New York State to dump in Angelica, and they're dumping it illegally in this dump.
See that what this is interesting. What you're saying is that, you know, the way they do things keep changing. You know, there's an evolution to to how they get rid of tailings, how they get rid of all these kind of waste. And this one, I've never heard of this one. I've heard of other ones, and again, they need to keep these things quiet because there is so much waste being produced by this fracking, by these fracking operations, by the drilling into the ground, by the wastewater, et cetera, et cetera. There's so much waste generated by it. There's not enough place for them to put it in. So they have to find ways to get rid of it. And this is a big issue. I mean, it's like, it's a little bit like nuclear energy, you know, like after a while, where do you put all the waste? It's an issue in our society. And, you know, like in Poland, for instance, you mentioned the non-disclosure agreements. And the techniques they use in Pennsylvania are the same techniques they use in Poland. Don't forget, the energy industry has been doing this for 100 years. They've been using lawyers and writing agreements for all this time. So they've got this thing worked out really well. So they know what they're going to do. But they underestimate the people sometimes, like it did in Poland because the farmers were against them. But there's one community that I was filming in Poland. It's a farming community, magnificent community, and you know, a small village there. And the Chevron went there, and they contracted for land. They leased land there with several small farmers, and these were the poorest farmers. So I went to the farmers to talk to them about the leases they signed, you know. And the farmer said, look, I can't talk about my lease. I can't even, you know, go on camera with you about my lease because there's an agreement that I signed where if I do that, I get fined. I can't talk about it. And much less talk about the details. I can't even say that technically I can't say that I signed a lease with Chevron, because if I do that, I'll be fined more money than they gave me. So how do you, I mean, to me, I think that should be illegal, that, you know, you can't disclose what's in your agreement. I mean, just think, this farmer is probably making, let's say he's making $1,000 for a year for, you know, in profit on his tiny farm, because it's like less than an acre. If this farmer gets an agreement, which I think was about 70 pages long, where is the lawyer that he can find to go for advice to sign this agreement? Can you imagine signing an agreement at 70 pages or more without having a lawyer? I mean, if you buy a car, you get advice for buying the car to sign the agreement. You know, these are complicated instruments that these people have in order to get this stuff out of your land, out of your soil. So this guy can't talk about it. He made a deal. Then he's afraid. And the other thing that's happened is that, and this is where the community comes in, four farmers in this community sign agreements. The other farmers are angry at them for doing this. So suddenly there's a war in the community, and people are not speaking to each other. And these are people that they grew up with. You know, these are not like strangers. They grew up with these people from grade school, you know. So suddenly these people are not talking to each other. They're like, you know, people are puncturing tires, and like there's like this community war going on. And this is poison. It's another form of poison in a community. Now, the reason why this is important to understand is because when you have four farmers in a community signing an agreement, that means that everybody in the community then has to allow the trucks and the infrastructure that they bring in to go through their territory, their land. So suddenly, a guy who's not making any profit or seeing anything from the gas because it's not being mined on his field, suddenly it's affected in a negative way. So you have four people in a community of several hundred, and those four people are then poisoning the lives of 200 people, of all these other families, and that's very unfair. Now, the other issue is that's the difference between Europe and America, is that in America, the mineral rights, whatever is in your soil, belongs essentially to the farmer, to the landowner. In Europe, it's a little bit different. In Europe, the agreement is to allow, to give permission to the company, to Chevron, for instance, in this case, to go on the land in order to drill. But once they get to whatever minerals or the gas that's underground, the farmer doesn't get a profit from that, because that stuff is owned by the state. So the state has made an agreement with the oil company, in this case Chevron, for the mineral rights. So Chevron gave them, you know, several million dollars in advance. And the profit that they make from this gas, and the profit can only come after they after they get after they recoup their costs. Poland was getting 0.5% of profit of that gas. Now just think about that. That gas belongs to Poland. It doesn't belong to the farmer even, right? And the company, the country is getting 0.5% of profit on that after the gas company sells it. What kind of deal is that?
That's a terrible deal. I had another question for you that was the way that they're drilling over there. How is that different from the ways that they're doing it here? I mean,
the drilling techniques are all the same everywhere in the world.
Okay.
The big difference is the geology. In Poland, the gas is much deeper. So I think they have to dig between 8 and 10,000 meters, which is a long way. In the States, you have various levels. You have various layers. So the first layer, I think, in Pennsylvania is a certain, 3,000 feet maybe. And I think it goes up down to the Utica, the layer, the Utica layer, which is what they call, it's not because of Utica, but it's what it's called. It's one of the deepest ones. So they use different technologies because they have to go deeper. So they use different drills and different drill bits. But the actual technology is the same.
But what's the incentive for people in Poland to allow this drilling? Because didn't you say that some of the farmers there, when this first started, they thought it was a good thing? So, I mean, I can understand it a little bit more here that people think that they're going to make a lot of money. But in Poland, that the farmers aren't getting any cash incentive.
Well, excuse me. Poland, like the rest of Western Europe, has to import all its energy sources. Gas, oil is imported. Shale, natural gas is imported from Russia and from other places, from England, from Scotland, from Norway. Poland has a huge amount of coal. Now, coal is a dirty. It's very dirty, but they've been using coal to make energy. These countries, including France, which has shale gas deposits, these countries, are all looking for energy sources. And one of the new energy source that they're selling is shale gas. But so that's why they're interested in it. It's the only reason why. But they didn't draw the complete picture of why they should invest in shale gas in Poland. So that's how they're selling it. They're saying that Poland will be independent with all this energy, and they're calling Poland the Kuwait of shale gas.
Well, they're saying the same thing here. So I'm thinking that that's industry propaganda, because here they're saying that it's going to make us energy independent, but at the same time they're saying that there's 14 permits on Obama's desk to change liquid natural gas importing ports into exporting ports, and Shell said that they intend on shipping the gas away. So it's not really for energy independence, and the multinational corporations owe no allegiance to U.S. citizens. So
look, if
do you think it's the same in Poland?
It's the same in Poland. It's the same everywhere. I mean, you have to understand that these companies, you know, all the geological testing they do in Poland, because I filmed that too. They do the test, and they send it all to Texas or to places in America to see what the potential is for shale gas, and then they make a decision. And these are very secret tests. So, for instance, when the shale gas things first started happening in Poland, the American companies, because most of them are American, they estimated that Poland had a 300-year supply of shale gas.
And there were American companies in Poland that were doing this?
Yeah.
It's just so interesting, because here we've got. It seems like, why is it that every country has a foreign company in there? Like here, we've got Norse, who's drilling.
Well, you also have Total is interested in the French company. They have investments in Pennsylvania. It's because of the energy industry is pretty small. It's not that big, you know. I mean, they have a lot of independent companies, but the majors are, you know, there's only a few of them. So they work things out between themselves.
Mm.
They said they had 300-year supply of shale gas. Now it's down to 30 years. It's a big difference.
Yeah.
And where, you know, how did, you know, this is a huge discrepancy. In a course of 2 years, they went from 300 to 30 years. And this is what's really interesting. And here, I think the problem with shale gas is that It was never fully thought out. The process was, they knew about the technology, but there's a lot of issues involved here. Now, from my research into the shale gas drilling, a shale gas well produces the most gas in 1 year. And after that, it drops down a lot. So when a well potentially has a 30-year period of life, that's it. And now, that hasn't been proven yet because they haven't been drilling for so long, especially in horizontal situations. So that means that they have to keep drilling these things and figuring out how long these things are going to last, how much gas they're going to produce. And it's geology. They don't really know what's underground. A lot of it is guesswork. I mean, they can figure out a lot of things, and they can do the seismic testing. They can do a lot of estimates. But what really is going on under there, who knows? So mm-hmm. It's not like oil. But there's more complicated stuff we'll get into a little bit later.
Okay, let's take a little break right here.
Sure.
And you're listening to 88.7 WHCL-FM, Clinton, New York.
Governor Cuomo is considering opening New York State to fracking. The gas industry says it's safe. Here's what our neighbors in Pennsylvania say, who have been living with fracking since 2004.
We were doing just fine until this drilling started, and then all of a sudden we're getting contaminants in our water, and we find it's not safe to drink.
If it was safe, then people wouldn't get sick and animals wouldn't die from drinking the water.
We got our air reports back yesterday. I found that there are 7 chemicals that are over the legal limit.
I've had inflammation of the cornea and chemical burns to my eyes.
My children have had nosebleeds and blisters in their mouths.
The gas is going to be gone, and we're still going to have dirty water and dirty air.
There's no money or anything worth trading your drinking water for.
When we first moved here, it was heaven on earth. Now it's hell on earth.
You have clean air and water. Preserve that. Preserve that with your life.
Tell Governor Cuomo, learn from Pennsylvania. Ban fracking. Call 855-675-9300.
So, welcome back. My guest today is Lech Kowalski. We're talking about his film Drill Baby Drill. And right before we took our break, you were talking about the estimated gas reserves in Poland being going from what was originally estimated for 300 years. 2 years later, they say, well, we think it's only going to be a 30-year supply. And that's so interesting because that mirrors what happened here. There's going to be a 100-year supply, and we're the Saudi Arabia of natural gas. They're saying that you're the Kuwait of natural gas, right, over there. I mean, you can see this pattern of how the industry is giving us these same lines, and I guess that they feel that we won't be communicating with, right, one another, so we won't know that they're using the same tricks on each of us.
It's an international issue, and you know, that's why I filmed The film is, part of it is filmed in Pennsylvania and part of it is in Poland. The main story is in Poland, but I refer to Pennsylvania in the film because in Pennsylvania, they've been doing it for 6 or 7 years and there's experience there, and there's a history there now that we can refer to. So I mean, what's interesting here is that as individuals and as a creative person, I had to learn about this. Geology was not one of my favorite subjects in school. I was, interested in film and art. But suddenly, I have to learn about this stuff. And I think that it's not that hard to learn about it. It's a question of paying attention. And I think one of the things that I learned on this film project was that, the farmers in Poland were really dedicated in their fight against Chevron. They had to finance their own operations to fight them because it's expensive, it takes time. They had to print all the posters. They had to learn about the technology. They had to learn about the laws because the laws were being changed by the gas companies as they were going into the country and as they are going into the country. So they had to deal with all these things, and they also needed, they can't afford lawyers, so they had to figure out, how to get free legal advice to keep fighting against Chevron. So they had to work on all these points, and plus, be active farmers. So, and they won, in two situations. So what that means is that, when you have something at stake, when you own the land, when you're a community, when you're connected to the community, when you're talking to the people around you, and you band together, it's like going to war, essentially. You can win, and a little guy can win if they figure out how to do this. And I think a lot of us will, or our kids or whatever, will probably be forced into situations in the future where they're going to have to fight for their environment, for their struggle, for their living situation. And they're going to have to do it that way, by banding together and by bringing, everybody sort of shares in this pot of knowledge. This guy brings this in, she brings that in, he brings this in, and together they share and they can fight, you can win if you band together and if you have the determination. And they have the determination because these are people, small farmers who've been living on this land for generations. You know, so they have a vested interest. Their parents and their grandparents were fighting against the Russians and the Soviets, and they were fighting against the Nazis. These were people that you know lived in the concentration camps. These people know about fighting. So the fight has now been taken from a war kind of situation where they're fighting with weapons to another kind of war, which is they're fighting with knowledge against for their land, against energy companies that want to just exploit as much as they can from their land and their environment and move on to the next place. And what do they leave behind? Well, it's unfortunate that these energy companies are not investing a whole lot more money and energy and time in renewable energy. And that's what they should be doing. So this shale gas thing came about around the same time where there was a lot of dialogue about renewable energy. And because of shale gas, that dialogue has sort of dropped off a lot. And the investment has dropped off a lot. Suddenly, you know, remember for a while, BP was considered a green company. They had green ads.
Beyond Petroleum, they were saying.
Right, exactly. And those ads have stopped.
Right.
They stopped. Well, they stopped for a lot of reasons. One of them is because of the disaster in New Orleans, which I made a film about too. But you know, you have to start, you know, looking at these things and understanding that corporations are very pragmatic. They're only interested in where the profit will come in the next year or so. They can't look beyond that. Big corporations are very complicated organisms that don't function properly because there's a huge amount of waste connected to them. And if you go to a gas well site, which I spend a lot of time on there, watching what they do, you can see a lot of waste just by paying attention to how they operate. For instance, a little example, they use a tremendous amount of traffic, trucks, etc., to drill for this stuff. In many places where I've watched them, they will have a truck standing there, the engine turned on for an hour as it waits for something to do something. How much gas is wasted doing that? Little details like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you start looking at things and paying attention to the little details, the bigger picture becomes kind of scary.
Mm-hmm. It seems like this is going to be a long fight, and I don't just mean for hydrofracking, but if we win the fight and keeping our communities protected, keeping hydrofracking out, there will be something that comes along in the next few years because corporations are continually influencing the legislative process. So, and they have an unfair advantage over us because of the money that they have in the process. So it's just going to be fight after fight of us trying to patch up holes where they're continually destroying things.
No, you're absolutely right, because the biggest industry of all, in terms of, it's not the biggest industry, it's the biggest source of problems for that the big industries create for us, is the lobby industry. The lobby industry is there to make sure that the corporation will make money. And that's all they care about. So they paint everything in a special picture to make sure that whatever activity the corporation's going into, they can extract as much profit as they can from whatever they're doing. And then the lobby, I don't know if the lobbying industry was born in Washington, but it sure is gearing up in Europe. There's going to be a screening of this film for the European Parliament. European Parliament is like the American, it's like Washington, you know, it's being shown where the government is, you know, the people are governing Europe. And I think there are 750 members in the parliament. I don't know how many are going to come to the screening, but this film is kind of like another way, another kind of lobbying, you know. So you've got this huge lobbying effort going on in Europe by the energy companies, etc. And then you'll have this little screening of this film, you know, to sort of counterbalance of it. But that's it. Mm-hmm. There's no other films like this, or there's no other efforts like this that are fighting against these big lobbying industries where people are making hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars a year to fight and help this industry pass through laws and to allow them to make profit from these things. So you have this little screening. We had a screening in Paris in the Paris Senate, in the French Senate rather, and that was very important because politicians came because they're learning about this, because they're trying to understand how to deal with this because they don't know themselves. Mm-hmm. All they're getting the information they get from about this is, you know, from a film like this or from the community that's against it or for it, and from the lobbying industry, from what the gas companies are saying. Try to, you know, pick up a brochure from a gas company, an energy company, and see what that brochure is saying. Brochures are really interesting. I saw the ones that they handed out in Poland, and they have pictures in these brochures. They're beautiful brochures, very expensive, you know, beautiful color, you know, photographs. And a lot of them had photographs from Pennsylvania. And what they show is they show a beautiful, pristine farm with a barn and a house, and everything's beautiful. It's airbrushed to make it look magnificent. And there's a little gas well stuck there, you know, somewhere. It's airbrushed in, maybe, or the airbrush helps. And I was with a farmer one day, and the farmer said to me, "Wait, look at this. Look, this is the brochure they're handing out to sell their shale gas thing." And he said something really obvious to me. He said, "Where's the people? Where's the people in that picture? Where's the farmer? There was no cars. There was nothing there. They airbrushed all of them out." So, you know, these are just little things they use to try to sell something, to try to sell themselves.
They don't have any pictures of the dead cows, or the fish kill, the people with their rashes.
No, those you can find on the internet.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, these are beautiful brochures that they spend a fortune on, you know, uh-huh. And they're a lie. The lie begins at the moment they hand you a piece of paper to sell, to say to you, "Can I come and, you know, make a deal with you for your land to have access to the potential shale gas?" The lie begins at that moment.
Now, the U.S. is getting into these negotiations for a trade agreement called the Trans-Pacific Pact. And this is problematic because for a lot of reasons. One, it's going to try to do away with buy local procurements and do away with advertising campaigns that are for sweatshop free goods. And they're saying that this is an unfair advantage. If you're running an ad that you're doing something that's sweatshop free, then it makes our product look bad.
Does that mean that the other stuff is sweatshop? You know, that's what it suggests, right?
Right. Well, that's what it suggests. So, I mean, that's the point of it, is to say that we're doing the right thing, and unless you see that we're doing the right, that the company's doing the right thing, you may want to think twice about it. But also, the another problem with it is that they're trying to do away with our home rule or our local jurisdiction over how we regulate these industries and keep them out of our state. So this is another threat to us. And I was just wondering if you know of any trade agreements in Europe that offer a similar type of threat.
I don't know about trade agreements. I know that there is a lot of talk between Norway and the northern countries to get gas and oil, because there's also shale oil, into Europe, and to bypass Russian and Chinese and American companies. So I really couldn't talk to you about that. It's a very specific subject. But there are other things that are going on, which is tax issues about how much the gas companies or the energy companies would be taxed for the shale gas that's coming out. And those taxes are connected to a fund, which is kind of like an environmental fund, where a certain amount of that tax money has to go in order to clean up potential problems. But the interesting thing about that is that because they're talking about having this fund, it's kind of like a super fund, it suggests to you immediately that they know there's going to be problems.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think you have to look, because, you know, these are all designed in kind of like 1984 newspeak, you know what I mean? Like when they say clean energy, that means that there's dirty energy, you know what I mean? So you have to sort of wonder why they're doing that. So so I don't know any more specifics about, you know, what you're asking about, but I do know that there's this tax issue going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going on in Poland, it's going on in France, going in a lot of countries where there is potential shale gas. And right now there's a moratorium in France, and France has a left-wing government, but it seems like the left-wing government is sort of bending, and they may allow shale gas drilling, but the French are very well organized, and it's the only country in the world where there is a total moratorium on drilling. So they'll fight, you know, they'll fight. And I think it's one of the reasons why a French television network finances film is they want to know what's going on.
And what other countries are they proposing shale gas drilling in?
Spain, Italy, Switzerland, Poland, France, England, Scotland, Ireland, and probably Belgium, if I didn't mention that. And I think that's it. It covers almost all of them. Oh, sorry. Of course, the other Eastern European countries, Romania, Greece, and Bulgaria. Bulgaria had a moratorium, and it may be changing. Chevron is specifically in Romania and in Bulgaria. And Bulgaria has been fighting against that in a big way. And Czechoslovakia and some of the countries above Poland, I think, are probably probably have shale gas too. So, or potentially have shale gas. So those are the countries that... So I probably named off almost all the countries in Europe.
What do you think it would mean to Europeans if the New York State bans hydrofracking?
You know, that's an excellent question or statement, because Europe is looking at America now very closely. They're looking at Pennsylvania, obviously, because Pennsylvania is kind of like the tragic test tube. It's the place that the Faustian deal has been made, and the people in Pennsylvania didn't have a reference point because they were the first ones, more or less. So, they're victims of hydrofracking operations. But New York State is like the hero in this scenario. Europe is looking at New York State because New York State is saying, hold off, there's a moratorium here, more or less. There's a moratorium for horizontal operations. I don't know if there's a moratorium for vertical. There may not be. I know it's complicated, because there have been vertical wells built in New York State, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I know. But Europe is looking at New York State, and if New York State goes in favor of shale gas drilling, I think it's going to have a huge impact on European countries, because New York State is one of the wealthiest areas of the world. It's a very wealthy... It's New York City is a very wealthy... It has a huge profile, And I think that the European countries will be swayed in many ways if they go for shale gas, as they are swayed now not to go for shale gas, because New York is holding back on it. So New York is very important
in the
entire world picture on this.
In Europe, is the radiation issue something that people are aware of, that the shale is radioactive?
The people in Europe are aware of the same issues that they are here in the States. And it is a big issue in Poland, because they've already had this problem where radioactive tilings were shipped off into an area that's near the Baltic, and it's a big scandal, and they're dealing with it now. So it's an issue there. They're aware of it. Yeah, it's not the kind of thing where every guy in every house in a neighborhood knows about it, but people that are interested in it know about it.
Because another issue that is closely related to that is after they pump the water and chemicals down, the produced water that comes back is very salty, but not only that, it's also very radioactive, and they've been proposing it in New York State, and they've actually done it, used it on roads to melt ice and snow. And the DEC, which is our Department of Environmental Conservation, is issuing permits to townships and waste haulers together for them to be using this product on highways, even though the DEC and other departments of the DEC has tested these wells and tested the water coming back out of them and found that they're 267 times more radioactive than the safe limit for discharge into the environment.
Wow.
So that's one more way that they're trying to get rid of the waste under the radar, I guess.
Yeah. Related to that, in Poland, there's a small community in eastern Poland where there's a business was suggested by the gas companies, and I'm not sure which one. And here's the business plan. They want a company, a small little company in that area to buy or to somehow obtain the tilings, the stuff they dig out of the ground, and mix that with other earth or whatever, and sell it as fill for people to use. Now the thing is that once you start drilling into the ground, you're gonna dig up all kinds of, depending on how deep you're digging, you're gonna dig up all kinds of things, and who knows what they are. They should be tested.
Mm-hmm.
I filmed a scene in a place where they're dumping all these tilings, in Poland. And what they did was they were mixing the Chevron and a few other companies were bringing all the tilings in, the stuff they were that comes out when they dig. They were bringing these things in and they were mixing it with small amounts of cement so that it would, and they were burying it underground. Now, why are they doing that? Why are they mixing it with cement? I mean, I don't know. And it was being all buried by this huge river. Now, eventually that stuff was going to leach into the river or wherever, you know. And this community was happy because they were making a little bit of money from, you know, because they have a garbage dump there. And I went there and they were just finishing this operation. And you can see that, you know, I shot some close-ups of this stuff on the ground. And you can see that just, it looks weird, you know. I mean, I didn't test it because it's not my, you know, I didn't have the budget for that. But you can see that there's something strange going on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, why are they mixing it with cement? What's in this stuff, you know? Why are they covering up? Why isn't there, like, a media campaign looking at this thing? Why isn't there somebody from the government there looking at this very carefully? And, you know, we're talking about a place that's very far away from everything, near the Ukrainian border, you know. Who knows what's being buried in there? I don't know, and they don't know. And the company just says it's safe. Well, do we take their word for it? I wouldn't
either. But even if the industry did everything proper, if they were regulated and held to all the standards of the Clean Drinking Water and Clean Air Acts, still there's the problem of then they contract with waste haulers to haul the waste away, and there's so much waste generated by this because each well is using, well pad could use 44 million gallons of water plus chemicals, and the chemicals in that ratio, if it was 0.5%, is something like 22,000 gallons of chemicals. And there's been numerous documented cases of illegal dumping by these waste haulers. One guy in Pennsylvania was charged with 99 counts of illegal dumping. He gets a slap on the wrist for it. His license is revoked. He pays a small fine. When he's faced several years in prison, and they gave him a small fine. He dumped it into sewers and rivers when people weren't looking, and he had a fish kill of 42,000 fish. And now the Attorney General for Pennsylvania is lobbying to even refund him his payment that he the fine that he had to pay.
It's extraordinary. I mean, you know, what you're pointing out is that there are so many places where there are problems that occur that were never anticipated by anyone, because even the oil companies, the energy companies, couldn't anticipate these problems because it just gets out of hand. Because you've got the element of humans making mistakes, you've got the element of geology being imperfect because it is by the nature of what geology is, you've got weather problems, you have methane problems, and that's another big issue. You've got methane coming out of the ground, you've got the issue of people not really knowing, you know, the workers themselves don't know about the entire process. So you know, little things happen, like we were in a site and a worker was bitten by a rattlesnake, you know, so they'd be rushed to the hospital, you know. So that means that the company was not even prepared for rattlesnakes being in the area, you know. I mean, there's like, I think that the whole thing was not fully thought through by the energy companies. They just went in as quickly as they can and tried to make profit out of this. I mean, look, this was discovered after World War II, and then Halberton in the 50s was the first company that made a deal for the technology of fracking. You know, now we all know who Halberton is, and you know, it's companies like Halberton who are in this industry. Halberton is in Poland in the fracking industry. I'm sure they're doing it here, and in fact, I know they are doing it because they sell the chemicals and they transport the chemicals in trucks that I filmed in Pennsylvania. So if you've got companies like Halberton, which are involved with this thing, this already should give us a red flag.
Mm-hmm. One of the chemicals that the company uses is glutaraldehyde, which is toxic at parts per trillion. So 1 gallon of that spilled turns a trillion gallons of fresh water into poison.
Wow.
So, I mean, it just seems that by design, this industry is problematic, because if you're going to have an accident with any kind of industry, you know, if you're using chemicals that aren't so dangerous, then the accidents aren't so devastating.
Well, you know, what you're bringing about is something that's really interesting, and I think this is a clue, this fracking thing is a clue to how our future is looking, you know. I think that you know, you have essentially a sort of a militaristic company, a country like America, which was really holds its power with the and maintains its power with the military. It's a very big business here, and part of that is the energy industry. I think a quarter of American of the oil used here in America is used by the military, which is a huge amount if you think about that. I think that the power structure, I mean, the people, the 1% or whoever they are, the people in power, they are going to think about things in this way. They're going to think about things in terms of, and I'm putting this in quotes, of what is a necessary sacrifice. And what I mean by that is that Pennsylvania, that area of Pennsylvania where they're doing the hydrofracking, to them, this is a natural, that's a necessary sacrifice. They're going to say, they're saying, okay, let that area be deteriorated ecologically, economically, or whatever else. We'll take extract as much as we can from there. Whatever happens there, because we need energy. We got to get it from somewhere, so we're going to sacrifice that area. But they're not going to sacrifice, for instance, areas that are important for New York City to survive, because, you know, like the watershed and stuff, they're not going to frack there. So all over the world, they're going to be looking, they're going to be dividing the world up into areas that where you have natural, that, you know, like you have these necessary sacrifices. And it means that certain people are going to be sacrificed, certain environments are going to be sacrificed, certain lands are going to be sacrificed for the power, for the people in power. And I think Utica and places like Utica, which are economically distressed, can easily fall into this necessary sacrifice kind of paradigm. Like, for instance, I mean, this is kind of a far cry from that, but, you know, like when America was experiencing over the last many years economic price problems, they decided, well, one way we can make money is with gambling casinos all over the country. A lot of places where they have the gambling casinos, those places are kind of cool and like maybe doing well economically, but in other ways everything around those areas is falling apart, you know. So those are like little miniature, like Atlantic City is really a good example of that, you know. So I mean, this is maybe a dangerous issue to bring up because they need to make money, but there, you know, like certain things will suck up all the energy in order to produce income or energy, and everything around it can fall apart because that area is kind of like no longer important for the power structure.
I think the term you're looking for is collateral damage. The military.
Collateral damage, yeah, absolutely.
Military term. Yeah. When you guys were in Pennsylvania, did you ever get a chance to interview people who worked for the gas companies?
This is a really interesting question because this is the big question, especially for a filmmaker like me, because there's two ways to make a film. There's the official way where you go in, you call up ahead of time, you say, can I see Mr. Joe from the company? And I want to set up an interview, and he's the vice president of operations for Chevron or whatever. And I hate shooting that kind of stuff because it's never going to produce anything truthful. So, yes, I interviewed some, but people are afraid to talk on camera. Mm-hmm. If a person from a company talks on camera, they have to get permission from the company. Usually two people show up, somebody to watch what they're saying. And it's that way I'm making films. I'm not making a film to make a guy, to light up somebody, to make him look good, or her. So yeah, I filmed people from the gas companies, but I didn't use any of that footage. Mm-hmm. I only filmed it because it's a process. The way that I film people from the gas companies is by doing it, not surreptitiously, but by showing up on location unexpectedly and confronting what they're doing. And usually they put up their hand, they said, you can't film this, you can't film me, blah, blah. But I filmed it anyways. And a few, you know, I did that almost, you know, almost every single day. And all that footage is sitting on my shelf. And from that footage, I extracted a few scenes that I think are very important to the film, to the story the film tells. And in those scenes, the real truth about what's going on comes out. Not because they wanted to tell me that, but it slipped out. Like, for instance, in one situation, I was there with Vincent, the sound man from Utica. And we were shooting a fracking operation just as they were starting fracking. It was right across the road from the farmer where it was a beautiful red barn. And right across the road is where the fracking operation is. And we showed up there. I pulled the camera out, put it on my tripod, and started shooting. And I'm on a road shooting down at the fracking operation. And I'm in a legal place where I can film. As I'm filming, a man starts walking towards me from the fracking operation. And he says, you can't film here. No, he says, you can't point the camera in that direction, and you can't film here. And because it's against the rules, whatever that means. And so I continued filming, and Vincent continued taking sound. And what happened was that during this encounter, I kept filming even when he thought I was not filming and he thought I was not recording. And during that encounter, what came out was this, was that he said, and he's a safety manager for the operation. Every fracking well, every operation has to have a safety manager for many reasons. And his job is to make sure everything is being done safely. So he knows. He's been trained in this. So he came up to the camera and he's talking and said, and you'll see in the film. And he says, well, you know what? For the next 25 or 50 years, there's going to be water coming up that's going to be poisoned. And that's just a fact, you know. After we leave, after the fracking is done, for the next 25 to 50 years, there's going to be water coming up that's polluted, you know, with all these various things that we're talking about. That's coming from the horse's mouth. Mm. Now, and he said to me, well, go down the road, you know, a few miles, and go down to the Chesapeake headquarters, Chesapeake Oil, or Energy, and they'll give you a brochure, and they have little videos, and they'll tell you everything about this. So I went there. There's no place written or stated that for 25 to 50 years, there's, you know, stuff is going to be coming out of the ground. But this guy told us. So yes, I filmed these people, but not in a way they wanted to be filmed.
Right. I just am wondering about the health of the workers who are working there. I mean, they're more intimately, it seems like they'd be more intimately exposed to the chemicals. And if they do get the chemicals on their clothing, I mean, that's a whole other issue, is if they're using laundromats in the community, that they're, the chemicals that are on their clothes are then getting into that machinery. If you have a restricted use pesticide license, you'll know that if you're working with pesticides, you're supposed to wash your clothes in a separate washing machine that's only designated for clothes that are used with pesticide. And so, I mean, this is a way that these are being brought into the community, but I'm also wondering about what is the health effects on the workers, and did you see anything about that?
I mean, I have so much material about this that it's extraordinary. Things that I didn't even film. I mean, always, you know, I mean, there's so many stories, and let me just point out a few because it gets complicated, and you get, you know, the technicalities, like, you know, can overburden the conversation because we can talk about this for hours. The trucks they use. Some trucks can haul fresh water. Some trucks can haul the poisoned water, the tainted water. And there's various degrees of tainted water. There's the stuff that has a salt in it. There's the stuff that has chemicals in it. There's the stuff that comes out of the ground. There's the bad water that they use that they pump in the beginning and that comes up. So at various stages of this stuff, there's different kinds of water. A lot of times they'll use the freshwater trucks to haul the dirty stuff. And then when your trucks are moving down the road, you can see the stuff spilling into the road, into the road surface. It's tainted water, you know. In the technology of fracking, there is three elements when they frack for the gas. And fracking essentially means this, that they're breaking up the shale gas. They're breaking up the shale in little bits and pieces, and this lets out the gas. So they, and this is, you know, this is like coal. Shale looks like coal. You know, it's like or like the shale that you can build, you know, sidewalks with, et cetera, et cetera. Anyways, when they do this, they need three things. They need a tremendous amount of water. They need chemicals, 600 different chemicals, depending on what kind of, on the geology. And they need silica sand. Silica sand is a very refined sand, very hard. And that's what's, when they pump in the water and sand under heavy pressure, the silica keeps the cracks open, and that releases the gas. They can only use this silica sand. Silica is carcinogenic. If it gets into your lungs, it's like it causes severe problems and you get cancer. It's a very refined material. And when you see it, you can see that there's something special about it. It comes from Wisconsin. Some of it comes from Minnesota. There is also, and it's in a film, there's also some being shipped in from China that may be radioactive already. And this silica sand is they use a huge, huge amount of it. They need, you know, tons and tons as they do the water. And it comes in on trains. And we filmed in a location where the station where they're bringing in the silica sand is located right next to a children's daycare center. And the Children's Daycare Center is about less than 50 feet from this thing. And the wind was blowing right into the, towards these children. And it's in a film. And there are no, and I went to it on location there where they're unloading this sand. There are no signs that say it's poison. None of the workers are wearing any masks. And in the New York Times, it states, I have a quote, and I have many quotes, that this stuff is carcinogenic. They should, you know, they have to be careful. It's kind of like the Love Canal situation in Buffalo, where, you know, after the spill happened, they have to go clean up and people get affected, et cetera, et cetera. When Love Canal was, as the chemicals were being pumped in there and it was affecting the neighborhood, there were no signs. People didn't know what's going on. Same thing with this. There's no signs that say, wear a mask, you know, be careful, it's dangerous. None. So this stuff is blowing and workers are working on top of the trucks and the train as they're coming in. This stuff is blowing all around. And my cameras cover the stuff. And it just had like this thin layer that I ran my finger across the camera. My finger was loaded with the silica. It's just amazing. And I learned this from the psychologist, and we did some further study on that. And it is indeed very dangerous. So there are big issues in Wisconsin right now about silica, where they're digging it up out of the ground. In Minnesota. And in fact, I think there's some filmmakers making films about that.
Hmm.
And it's kind of like the unknown issue about hydrofracking. And it's... And because it needs such huge amounts that, it blows in the air and you know, it'll only be in a few years when people will discover if they have cancer or whatever or what it did to their lungs.
My partner...
It's like asbestos, sure. Like the asbestos issue. Like in the beginning when they were using asbestos for building, nobody thought about it, but then it became a big issue.
In Ohio, there's this program that's happening with the... Well, my partner's brother lives in Ohio, and he's an attorney there, and he went to the seminar, and in the seminar they were talking about this new program they have for people so that when they get sentenced at court, and they can choose, instead of going to jail, to work for the natural gas industry on these rigs, and they're thinking that because these people... have committed crimes that their lives are less valuable and they're disposable. They're a disposable workforce, and so I think that it's happening in Texas, and you know I heard that this was proposed in Ohio, the idea that we'll be using prisoners to do the work here.
It's extraordinary. I mean, I can tell you a little story that I experienced in my life in making this film. Through a friend of mine in New York, I met a man who has a company in Holland, and his company does seismic testing. So he works directly for the shale gas industry. And he's a very knowledgeable man. He's a rock and roller. He's got a rock and roll band. He's about 60 years old. He's an amazing character, very aware, you know. And he's looking at this thing sort of philosophically. Of course, he's making a living from it because he has his company and he's got a beautiful house in Holland, in Amsterdam, and he travels around the world testing, doing this seismic testing. And this is the first stage of looking for shale gas deposits. And so he's come to his conclusion is that this is an unsafe practice. There's a lot of problems with it. And he's very angry at the industry because he thinks it's going too fast. And he's part of the industry, so he's like trying to, you know, he's doing whatever he can, but there's only so much he can do because he's got to survive, et cetera, et cetera. He's been, his whole life is, he's a gas man, an energy man. So he, I was talking to him for a long time to get information from him, and he's been advising me on this film, who to talk to, et cetera, et cetera. At one point, it became problematic because he contacted people in Poland that work in the industry. They found out about me filming. I had to sort of cut my ties for a while because there was like some secrets coming out about me that I didn't want them to know what I'm going to be filming and where. Yeah. Anyways, what's interesting is that this man has a daughter. His daughter met a guy who was a vet from Iraq, and he came back to America after the war, and he couldn't find a job. The only job he could find was to work as a driver in the shale gas industry in Pennsylvania. And he was really devastated that his daughter is going out with a driver who's a military guy, you know, because there's no work. So he went from being working in, you know, being in the military in Iraq to you know, working for the shale gas industry. And the guy is not happy doing that, but it's the only job he can find. You know, so these things get complicated, you know. Who's going to work on all these things? What kind of, what's the caliber of workers, you know? Where they come from, you know, and why? Because people need to earn a living. Mm-hmm. So the energy companies have a lot of power over us, because always the argument, every place when it comes to shale gas operations, from the community is always this: we need money, we need jobs. This is true in all over Europe, where they want to do this. In France, and I've been to these places, I've filmed in Poland. In these communities, the argument is: we need the jobs. They're going to provide us some jobs. Now, most of the jobs that are good jobs are done by professionals who work in the industry, and you know, but there is some jobs that they, you know, they do filter down, but they never say that it's good for the community because it's, you know, because the energy is good or because it's going to help something or whatever. It's always about this job thing, which is like, it's not necessarily a good argument. You know, you can, yeah, we're going to build, you know, a nuclear facility here, you know. Yes, it'll create jobs, but it's going to also cause other problems, you know. So I think we have to look at this picture in a bigger way.
Yeah, jobs is such a poor excuse. Yeah. You know, we need jobs. Let's build a prison and put our community members in it.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it'll be good work. People can work as guards, you know. Uh-huh. So, yeah, so they privatize the industry of prisons, right?
Uh-huh.
Which is, it is privatized to a certain degree. And what happens when they do that? Well, they want more prisons because the corporations need to make a profit. You need more prisons, and then you need more prisoners. So you have to have more laws to make things difficult. So you're busting, you know, young kids selling pot and putting them in jail for a few years, you know, to increase this volume in these prisons, which are privatized, you know. Privatization is very dangerous.
Another peculiar thing, just that now that we're on this tangent, is in New York State for the marijuana laws, it's a $250 fine if you have less than an ounce. But then over that, it's a $250 fine or a year in prison. And then you get to the next size bigger, and it's a $250 fine or 5 years in prison. So, you know, so it's this disproportionate sentencing that you can get. And then, you know, inevitably that sentencing becomes discriminatory over the color of your skin.
No, look, I have a lot of stories about the whole drug thing because, you know, I worked in rock and roll films for a long time. Part of my life was spent in that subculture, as you know. I won't get into it, but I do have a very good friend of mine who went to Harvard. He's an amazing person, and for a good part of his life, he was a drug dealer. He dealt drugs to some very big people, you know, that you would know about, but I won't mention any names. He went to Harvard. He was busted. He was filmed in New York City, you know, doing transactions involving cocaine and heroin, and it was a pretty serious operation. You know, I mean, you know, a lot of money was involved, but because he went to Harvard, he got off in a very interesting way. He got off going to jail to Rikers Island on weekends, Friday from 5 o'clock until Sunday until 5 o'clock, for 2 years, and then after that, they put a little thing on his, you know.
Tracking thing,
yeah. To, you know, because he's white, you know, his educational background, where his family comes from. So, you know, I don't know what this has to do with fracking, but it has to do with showing how our system works.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen any of the documentation in Pennsylvania of all of the people who used to work for DEP, which is their Department of Environmental Protection, and how many of those people who used to work for DEP are now working for the gas industry, and the people who used to work for the gas industry are now working for DEP. And there's a 32-page document explaining this.
No, that's extraordinary. So let me talk about my film related to that.
Sure.
Okay? And to the previous film that I did with the farmers. And this is an extraordinary example of what you're talking about. And I was there. There was a meeting set up by Chevron between the farmers in a village, about 50 farmers, and farmers and their wives, and, you know, of course, the women are farmers too. And the children were there. And this meeting was set up during a week. It started at 8 o'clock, and it ended up going to 1 o'clock in the morning. Now, if you're a farmer, you can't spend that much time, you know, in these kind of meetings, because you have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and work and stuff. Anyway, so this meeting was set up by Chevron in a firehouse in this little village with the farmers and with the head of Chevron for Poland and his Polish assistant who translated for him from English to Polish and vice versa. And this was the head of Chevron, up for all of Poland, the top guy, makes a lot of money. And there was a third person there who represented the government. And she was there by invitation from Chevron. And she worked for the governor of that area. And she was very strange during a meeting. In the middle of the meeting, she ran away because the farmers were confronting. There was a fight in this thing, and we were filming. Now, Chevron said that they don't want this thing to be filmed, and the mayor of this town, of this village, said if they don't allow me to film, there'll be no meeting. And this was at a critical meeting point where Chevron wanted to build this gas tower, this drill. So Chevron agreed to let it be filmed. I was filming it, and during the meeting, about halfway in the meeting, this woman ran out, a woman who works for the governor. And then she left a message with the mayor for me to call her the next day. So I called her, and she asked me for a copy of the footage. She wanted to show it to the governor. And I said, I can't agree to that. I just can't, you know, because something seems strange. So she called me back and forth. We talked over a period of weeks. She really wanted this footage, and she wanted to know what the film was being used for, what the footage is being used for, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then I broke off my relationship with her because it was very strange. I just didn't want to give her the footage. 4 months later, now listen to me, 4 months later, I found out that this woman left her job working for the governor, and now she works for public relations for Chevron. Now, it's possible that she was working for Chevron then. I don't know.
Hmm.
So this is how they work. They take people from the community, from the government, from whatever, who have been in positions where they have influence or they learned, and they use them. The chief, the head of publicity in Poland for Chevron is a woman who was a newscaster for 20 years. So she has this newscaster's face, you know, everybody knows her. She's the head of PR for Chevron. Whenever there's a problem, you have to talk to her about, you know this thing. And I filmed her, and I have some amazing footage with her. She's in this film that's playing on Saturday. So yeah, you know, this is just two examples of how they operate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like to really...
But excuse me. Sure. She's a journalist. I just want to explain to you. She was a journalist that worked on television as a news and a news reporter, right? A presenter, you know, mm-hmm. like the evening news. She is now the head of publicity or public relations for Chevron, for the country, you know? It's mm-hmm. like, you know, it's like getting, I don't know, Walter Cronkite or something. I mean, I don't be, you know, it's a little excessive, but just imagine. But just think about what that means, you know?
Right. Because people do get these certain sentimental connections to the people they're seeing on their television screen.
Exactly, yeah.
Just want to remind people and encourage them to come out for the film, Drill Baby Drill. It's going to be this Saturday at the Uptown Theater in Utica, New York. That's 2014 Genesee Street, 4 o'clock p.m. The film's 84 minutes. Afterward, there'll be a question and answer session. And
you can go to have coffee at the Domenico Cafe across the street.
Yes.
There's we have a little food there.
There's a coffee shop there. And also there'll be the short presentation.
Right, by the psychologist.
By a psychologist there. And
also somebody's coming up from New York to film it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Excellent. And then there'll also be some people from Pennsylvania who've been... They've been negatively impacted by the gas drilling. So you can, ask them questions. If you're out there listening, you're concerned about shale gas drilling in your community, you could encourage your town board members, your elected officials to come see the film and participate in the discussion afterward.
And this is not a propaganda film. It's not like, you know, it's like it's a very honest depiction of what goes on. I think it's important because, you know, sometimes if people don't like to see activist kind of stuff, you know, because they this film is just about the reality.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the really important points is it's a chance for people to not have to drive all the way to Pennsylvania to speak with someone who's experienced it from Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
The problems that they've experienced are not well... not well known, not well publicized. So, for people who want to understand it better, this is a great opportunity to understand the risks associated.
Yeah, it's the underground look at shale gas drilling.
Yes, well, interesting. Yeah, underground from the underground.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Lek, for joining me this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.